In the whole history of man, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower clear.
I'm here with former Chief of Public Information and Public Affairs for NASA, Jack King. Everybody knows the voice of Jack King. He was the one that provided the incredibly dramatic descriptions of every single launch in the Apollo program. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Well, nice to talk to you, James.
You know, Jack, I got to tell you, you had me on the edge of my seat every time I watched a launch.
Well, very good. There was wasn't as much me as what was going on, I would expect.
I know, but you know, when I compare the current announcers that do the launches for NASA, you were able to convey a sense of drama and gravity to what was about to happen. Whereas when they do a launch of the shuttle today, it's like I'm listening to NPR.
Yeah.
It's like, and liftoff of the space shuttle challenge. You know, it's just that type of thing. But for you, it really gave us a sense of the historic nature of what was about to happen. And as we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the moon landings, I'm really excited to be able to ask you to take us through your journey that took you to Apollo and your impressions of your experience during that time. So how did you get involved as the public affairs officer for NASA?
Well, I'm originally from Boston. I was born and brought up in Boston, a very proper Bostonian. Went to Boston College, a good Jesuit college. That's where I learned how to count backwards, which was very important. And right after Explorer 1 went up in 1958, I was a newsman. I followed my father's footsteps. He was sports editor for Associated Press in Boston for about 25 years. And when I returned from Korea after getting my degree, I went to work for Associated Press as well. Right after the Explorer 1 launch in 58, AP determined that there was enough going on down here that we better open an office. So my bureau chief recommended me to open up the first AP office at Cape Canaveral, and I came down in April of 58. I covered the missile launchings for Associated Press for the next 2 years. It was quite a challenge in that time because, if you remember, at that particular point, we were in the process of the start of a real missile race. The Soviet Union was at the height of its power. They were rattling their rockets at us, and we were trying to develop enough rockets so we could rattle back. There was the development of the Atlas and then followed on by the Titan with the ICBMs. We had a lot of failures in those days, and as a reporter, it was difficult to describe the explosions differently each time they occurred. But at any rate, that's what brought me into the business. NASA was created in 1958 and established its first presence at Cape Canaveral in 1960. That was when the Von Braun team came over to NASA, and the missile firing laboratory of the Von Braun team, headed by Kurt Debus, established its first operations at the Cape. I was offered the job from NASA to be director of public information at that time, and I was certainly very much involved in the space program and just jumped at the opportunity. And I'm always glad I did. So I started off with NASA in 1960. Now, during the first couple of years, I did a whole number of countdowns, but all of those were the unmanned launches, the weather satellites, the communication satellites, and pioneer launches, flights to the moon, flights to Mars, and that type of thing. And got a lot of experience along those lines. before I got into launching in the manned space flight business. Actually, when we became a center, meaning the NASA facility down here in the early 60s, it was determined that a representative from the Kennedy Space Center, what had then become the Kennedy Space Center, should do the launch countdowns. During the Mercury program, Colonel Shorty Powers did the counts, working for the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston at that time. So this all changed, and I started my first, the first countdown I did in the manned program was Gemini 4. That was Ed White's rather dramatic spacewalk on the first flight. You asked me about my reporting on launches, and I think the best thing I can say is, as a former newsman, I always looked at it as a news event. And the purpose of my countdown was to inform the media and the American public on what was going on at that particular time as a news event. And so as each particular special activity came up in the launch countdown, I did my best to describe it. I tried to be precise. I didn't add any lace to it or anything else. My purpose was to say very simply, this is what's going on at this time, and this is what's coming up. And that was sort of my whole attitude. I always worked from notes. I just had a few cue cards after spending long, long hours with the fine people who put together the Apollo countdown. Back in the mid-60s, there was a wonderful guy named Clyde Netherton. And Clyde was one of the people who were orchestrating the Saturn V countdown. Like composers in a back room, they were orchestrating the whole thing, about a 500-page document. And after work, I'd get together with Clyde, and we'd just go over the countdown time and time again. What's happening when this occurs? What does this mean? And all those type of things. I did it with a launch vehicle, and then I also did it with the spacecraft, with the spacecraft test conductors. So I got an awful lot of help at that time. But my idea was just, I was looking at it just from my reporter's point of view. What are the facts, ma'am? And here they are.
Well, it certainly did that. I mean, I kind of did get the sense you were almost acting as a newsman, and maybe that's what brought about the dramatic effect of watching the launch. And it was almost like a color commentary for you on your point of view. And as a kid growing up, I learned so much about the space program during the launch just by listening to those facts as you reported them. And I think that a lot of that is lost today. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think it's because the fever pitch passion of following the space program has mellowed tremendously that we kind of have lost that in our space program?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. That's very true. You see, the difficulty is when we started out early in the Mercury days and then into Gemini and Apollo, thanks to President Kennedy giving us that mandate in 1961 to land astronauts on the moon before the end of the decade. And by the way, of course, we did that, and we came in on time and on the money. But at that particular time, we had quite a missile race going on that turned into a space race in the early 60s. The attention of the public was tremendous. And we had the American public behind us. That was one of the big things. I'll be happy to get back to that. But in relating it to the shuttle program, which has been going on for the last 30 years, that same attention and national support, avid national support, has not been there. And some of the obvious reasons are that the shuttle is completely misunderstood. It's done a fantastic job putting together that space station, which we will rely on for the next 5 or maybe hopefully 10 years, and it was very worthwhile. The problem is that with the shuttle goes up, docks with the space station, and comes back. And so in the eyes of the American public, without appreciating it at all, for many of them, it turns out that they just feel ho-hum, they're doing it again under certain circumstances. Going back to the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs, everything we were doing was for the first time. And so there was major interest, and since everything was sort of different each time, it really kept the nation's interest behind the program.
So as a public affairs officer, do you kind of think that the space race in the 60s kind of took on a life of its own, and that and that the PA officers at NASA now have a much harder job?
Well, in a sense, certainly getting the public to understand and appreciate the program, which the shuttle has done a fantastic job. You know, we had two catastrophic failures, but my goodness, we've launched it, what, about 130 times now, and it has a fantastic record. And I just hate to see it go, but that's it, just as we had to face it in the early 70s with the Apollo program, it's happening again. Of course, it's giving away to Constellation, which I hope and expect will be a very thrilling program over the next 20 years.
What do you think about the Constellation program?
Well, I think the goal is a very worthy goal, to land astronauts on Mars, and I think it makes sense to establish, not just to go back to the moon for going back to the moon's sake, but to establish a real base on the moon from which we can extend out. And so I think it makes sense. I just hope and expect the development of the early tests of the vehicle prove out, and that we'll be able to proceed.
Now, I do understand the need to use a more advanced launching system, but what I'm a little bit confused with is that we kind of had the argument about launching multiple launch vehicles and assembling the stack in space versus a one launch to get into space, and I thought that argument was over with Apollo, but now they're doing it the other way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And I don't understand, from my point of view, as someone who, as a child, lived through Apollo. Apollo was my wonder years, and seeing what they're doing now, I don't see the sense in it.
Well, you have to, as you look at the future program, you have to base it on what we have developed thus far. And what appears to be the most reliable in the minds of NASA are the solid fuel boosters used for the shuttle. And so that will be the makeup of both Ares 1, the smaller vehicle that will carry the crew and the spacecraft, and Ares 5, which will bring up the lunar module and all the other aspects that are required to go back to the moon and required to go to Mars. So you're using the most reliable vehicle. Now, in the meantime, of course, we have this Augustine study going on, and we'll just have to see what the results of that are and see if they reinforce NASA's plans as they currently stand.
Is that, are you referring to the one where pitch that happened just earlier this week, where they pitched using the same shuttle stack and just putting a cargo carrier on?
Yeah, what they're doing is they're looking at all, what are the various possibilities in addition to the current configuration for the Constellation program. That is, going back to a concept that we had, my goodness, in the early days, and that was to take one of the unmanned vehicles, such as the Delta IV, and man-rate it and send up the spacecraft that way versus sending it up on Ares 1. Those are, the president has asked that the Augustine committee assess all of that and come back with a report in August. So we will see where we go from there after that report comes out.
I see. And what about the quote-unquote rebel engineers that came up with a separate proposal which would basically take the Ares 5 and use it as an all-up vehicle?
You get all kinds of suggestions from people in the space business without any question. We're going to have to rely on NASA's expertise that they make the right decision and that they proceed accordingly.
Does this kind of remind you of when they were developing the developing Apollo, and at the time nobody wanted to talk about lunar orbit rendezvous, and then all of a sudden it became the method of choice?
Oh, yeah, they looked at about four or five different ways back in the early days. See, once President Kennedy gave that go to the moon, they assessed all kinds of possibilities, and there were some pretty strong arguments, and not necessarily arguments, but strong presentations within NASA itself on the best way to follow. And after listening and determining all of that, the decision was made to use the transposition and docking in Earth orbit, and then the lunar orbit rendezvous and the landing. But there was big studies made on that, and they just felt that was the best way to go, and that's how the Saturn V rocket was developed.
So as a public affairs officer, your job was more than just doing the countdown.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Let me give an example since we're coming up on the anniversary of Apollo 11. That was on Wednesday, July 16th, 1969. About 6 or 7 days before that, since I was the chief of information, I had to oversee the opening of a big news center in the city of Cape Canaveral. You see, we had more than 2,800 news media accredited from that launch. The top news guys from all over the world, from 57 different countries, in addition to the United States. Now, we had to run that news center on a daily basis, doing all kinds of briefings, tours, status briefings, and news releases, status reports, and everything else that went on. And you know the news media as well as I, they always want more. So I described that activity. When you consider there's 2,700 of them, and also we have to set up all the television coverage for all the world's networks in addition to the United States, we faced an awful lot of challenges. I always describe the operations in the news center as organized chaos, but it worked out very well. In fact, I've said very often it was kind of a relief to go out to the firing room and get away from that madhouse for a few hours to do the countdown. And of course, that's the way it was, starting off in Mercury and all the way through Apollo, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. So our responsibilities were concerned with all the news operations.
And not to mention that
countdown really was a sideline, if you will.
Yeah, and not to mention having to keep track of all those astronauts tooling around in their Corvettes.
That's true.
I'm really having a good time reading a lot of the different Apollo bios where they get, you know, at this state they're getting pretty frank about, you know, what they went through, and I really appreciated Alan Shepard's bio that his wife wrote, where she was talking about how Shepard had to go get a fellow astronaut who was in trouble. All these different things. It's a very, very interesting time, I'm sure, for you. So
one of my favorites was back at when we were preparing Alan Shepard for the first launch on the lighter side. Gus Grissom was Alan's backup for that particular flight, for that first flight. And, of course, they delayed the announcement on officially who was going to go till relatively a short time before launch. You had Glenn Grissom and you had Shepard. Now, Al and Gus had side-by-side rooms at the Holiday Inn in Cocoa Beach. And, of course, Alan was out at the Cape all the time, intensely preparing for the launch. Gus, as the backup and the support, didn't have as much pressure on him. And one particular night, Gus was quite a character, by the way, and one particular night, Gus jumped into his Corvette and headed up to Titusville to see some friends. And on his way back, probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, he was on, if you're familiar with the geography here, he was on Route 1 going from Titusville back to Cocoa Beach, and he decided to test out, a good test pilot that he was, he decided to test out the Corvette. And he was hitting about 110 miles an hour when he attracted a state trooper. The state trooper picked him up as he turned the curb to go across the causeway to Cocoa Beach. He picked up the Cocoa police, the Brevard Sheriff's Office, and by the time he hit the A1A in Cocoa Beach, he picked up the Cocoa Beach police. He roared into the Holiday Inn, and it turns out Alan had parked in Gus's parking space. So Gus pulls in to Alan's spot, jumps out of the car, and jumps into his room. The police come in with sirens blaring and the blue lights and the red lights, and in their brilliance, they go over and they see the two white Corvettes. They put their hand on the hood of one of them, and it was obvious that that was the one, and they start bashing down Alan Shepard's door. And Gus opens the door in his shorts and says, "Could you keep it down out there? We're trying to get some sleep." So that was one of the lighter stories at the time.
Oh, yeah. I hear that he had quite the reputation for that. And actually, they all were pretty much pranksters from Wally.
But Gus was a heck of a pilot. He was a heck of a pilot. So, he was a fine astronaut. It was a great loss.
So let's I assume, and forgive me if I'm overstepping here, but I assume that the low point for you was the Apollo 1 fire.
Oh, sure.
No question about it.
From a
PR perspective, how do you deal with that?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I was in the blockhouse that night. I was in the blockhouse actually for 10 hours, my God. It was called the plugs out test. It was a normal test with the Saturn 1B. And we had the Grissom, White, and Chaffee in the spacecraft. And it was a very long afternoon. You simulated certain things for the final countdown and liftoff, but the plugs were out, meaning, you know, there'd be no effect on the vehicle itself. It was sort of a rehearsal for everybody. And at that particular time, we just had all kinds of problems during the day. One of the major ones was just some communications. And at one particular point, Gus, very frustrated, came back over the line to the blockhouse and said, how can we go to the moon when we can't communicate between two buildings? So they had a lot of dissatisfaction with what was going on, and, of course, with the spacecraft as well. And then, of course, that horrible moment at 6:31, it was a Friday night, when we heard fire on the spacecraft, and that changed everything. We lost all three astronauts, as you know. They didn't burn to death, by the way. They died of anoxia, actually, because there was an implosion inside the spacecraft, and all the oxygen had burned up. We had to spend many hours further in the blockhouse, because sitting on top of the spacecraft was a 155-pound thrust escape rocket, and they were concerned that that might go off as well. So we spent a lot of time in there. Now, when that occurred, I alerted our top leadership in Washington by phone and then stood by. Deke Slayton was in the blockhouse, and I immediately agreed with Deke that I would make no announcement whatsoever and before the three widows had been personally informed by Deke. I certainly did not want Betty Grissom to hear of her husband's demise with my announcement. I was criticized somewhat for that, but I never regret it. When I lived in Houston, Betty Grissom was my neighbor across the backyard, and something I always remembered. So that was a terribly tragic incident. When they did the investigation, they just saw a fire trail, flammable material that went right across the base of the spacecraft. And, of course, the hatch, they couldn't open the hatch. And so that set down the Apollo program. For quite a while. Actually, the spacecraft would not fly again for 22 months. They basically tore it apart and put it together and did the quick opening hatch and all the other safety additions at that particular time. Now, the interesting thing is it was a tragic incident, and it was the lowest point in our program at that time with the Apollo program. I agree with a number of others. It's very ironic. Had that not happened, we probably never would have been able to get to the moon, because if there was a catastrophic accident like that on the way to the moon or anywhere in between, that probably would have ended the program. So that was a major contribution, as tragic as it was. Well, we had that low point in January of 1967, but just 10 months later, we came back with the first launch of the Saturn V rocket. A very majestic rocket, 365 feet high, three stages, three liquid fuel stages, and, of course, the Apollo spacecraft atop that. The Saturn V had been designed and developed by the Von Braun team, and then we had an outstanding team of contractors. Boeing did the first stage, North American Rockwell the second stage, and McDonnell Douglas the third stage, and, of course, North American once again had the spacecraft. So it was quite a team. The first launch of the Saturn V, the determination was made that we'd use what's called the all-up concept. That is, the first time you launched it, you had all three stages ready to go, fueled, and ready to go on the very first test. It turned out the first launch was highly successful. Of course, it was something we all remembered, because we didn't know at that time what the sound would do, particularly in the explosive equivalent. All kinds of studies had been made, which located the launch control center and the press site just about 3 miles from the launch pad. That was based on explosive equivalent and also acoustics. Interesting enough, some of the acoustic studies, they picked up what the acoustics would be if you sat in the first row of a hard rock band, and they tried to compare that to different things. That was one of many studies that went on. At any rate, in preparation for it, We weren't sure what was going to happen. We issued earplugs to all the news guys at the press site. And the first time it lifted off, I counted it down and then looked over my shoulder. And then, as it always happened with the Saturn V, I say liftoff, I look over my shoulder, and there's that majestic vehicle still sitting in a bed of flames. It looks like it would never go. It seemed an eternity. And then all of a sudden, slowly, it lifted off. It took more than 7 seconds just to clear the tower. But on that first launch, when the sound hit us in the launch control center and also at the press site, all the windows in the launch control center started to rattle severely. And it was a newly built building. So further thing was that the sound caused all the construction dust in the ceiling to start coming down. I thought the whole darn building was coming down on us for a minute there. And in the meantime, over at the press site, good old Walter Cronkite was sitting in his trailer reporting on the launch, and he got knocked right off his chair. But so it was very dramatic along those lines. And it was a very important milestone, if you will. After we reached our low point, as I said, in January of 57, we came back and we were able to get this highly successful first launch of the Saturn V. The Saturn V was a great performer. We actually launched it 13 times, 12 times in the Apollo program and one time for Skylab. And every time it was performed beautifully and did its job. So it was quite a remarkable vehicle.
So then we get to the... We're rapidly approaching the 40th anniversary of Apollo 11. So we make our way through all the various flights, building up to the first manned space landing. When did you find out that it was going to be the crew of Apollo 11 that was going to make the first landing?
Oh, quite a while earlier. The crews were laid out. The crews were laid out pretty well. You had Borman, Lovell, and Anders on Apollo 8. Well. Shirai, Risley, and Cunningham was Apollo 7, which was the Earth orbital flight of the Apollo spacecraft, the first launch after we lost Grissom, White, and Chaffee after it had been fully repaired. And then Apollo 8 was a very daring mission. It surprised all of us at the particular time. The lunar module wasn't ready by that time, so the determination was made to go to the moon and to go in a lunar orbit. Part of what forced that, I believe, in the minds of many was there were all kinds of indications that the Russians were really going to start to try to do things with the moon, and the determination was made we wanted to continue. So we had that tremendously dramatic flight of Apollo 8 when Borman, Lovell, and Anders went in a lunar orbit, and the very dramatic pictures of our beautiful planet from the moon, and, of course, the reciting from the Bible of Genesis during Christmas Eve, which everybody certainly remembers.
Yeah, let's talk about that because from a PR perspective, that must have made your life a little interesting.
Oh, sure it was. Sure it was. I love the story of that where out in Houston, at the time that they were reading from Genesis, there was a whole horde of foreign press, of course, covering all the Apollo launches. And there was a Japanese reporter, I'm told, who had worked all day, and he was still a couple of hours from deadline, but he had done all his reporting, and he came back to his motel, turned on the TV, and all of a sudden he hears the astronauts reciting from Genesis. And he immediately calls the news center, since he still had time to meet his deadline, and he said, when will the transcript be available on that? And they said probably about an hour and 45 minutes, which would be too late for him. So the public affairs guy on the other end suddenly thought of something. He said, look, sir, open the drawer in your desk there beside the bed, and you'll see a black book. Open to page 8, and there's your transcript, which I always thought was a cute line.
That's classic.
Of course, it was the Bible.
That's classic. So, and then so we get to Apollo 11, and everybody in the world, it seems, including myself, was watching the landing. Take us through your experience of where were you at the time? Were you in Houston or
the lunar landing?
Yeah, during the lunar landing.
Yeah, I was very proud. Julian Scheer, who is the assistant administrator for public affairs, invited me into the control room at the public affairs booth for the lunar landing. So I was right there in mission control at the time. You see, the way we operated was after I would do the countdowns here, I, along with a number of other public information guys from Washington, from Huntsville, would head out to Houston to give the folks in Houston a hand in the new center out there during the operations that followed. So I was already out there at that particular time and was fortunate enough to be in mission control when it occurred.
So was there a different set of PR people for Houston as opposed to Florida?
Oh, yeah, sure. They had their own staff and everything else. And their guys would pick up on the commentary. The way it worked was I would do the countdown, and once the Saturn V cleared the tower, my last words would be tower clear, and then Houston and Mission Control picked up the mission, and both operationally and from a public affairs point of view.
So
that's where all the information was coming.
So you do the handoff, and then you immediately go towards preparing for the next flight then?
No, I go out to Houston and give them a hand through the rest of the mission, and then, of course, get back. I had a day-to-day business in the public information office to run on a daily basis with all the news media here and news media who would come in. And so that was a day-to-day. It was a very busy schedule. Certainly, I'd get ready to prepare, but that would just be a few days before launch.
And then we get to Apollo 13.
Yeah.
Again, another interesting time in the life
of
a NASA public affairs
officer. You see, I had done about six or seven Apollo countdowns by that time, and I had a deputy named Chuck Hollinshead, and I wanted Chuck to get some experience. So I asked Chuck, and he was willing to do it, to do the commentary for Apollo 13. And I've always reminded Jim Lovell of this, but I didn't do his countdown. Maybe that was part of the problem. But at any rate, I did not do that countdown, but I was right there at the press site, of course, running the whole operation.
During those four, because I didn't get any sleep for 4 days. I was 9 years old, and my dad just, you know, my sister said, "Aren't you going to make him go to bed?" And my dad said, "He'll fall asleep. Don't worry." And I didn't get any sleep for 4 days. I was really on pins and needles.
Yeah, we were certainly all the same way. What a dramatic salvation, if you will, after that explosion, for God's sakes, in space, and the work of the guys in Houston with Gene Kranz and the whole team in the Mission Control Center, and the fantastic job they did to bring those guys back. It was just most remarkable, and it's really one of the highlights of the Apollo program, without any question.
So I want to look back on through the entire course of the program, where obviously everybody in the news wanted to get a piece of any astronaut or any astronaut's family. You see those classic scenes from the Wright stuff and from Apollo 13 and from the Earth to the Moon, where the news trucks are putting equipment on, you know, Marilyn Lovell's property. And as a PA guy, did you have to deal with the crushing amount of requests for contact between the news and the astronauts, and in particular their families? That must have been
two different things there. One of the jobs, after I completed my work at the Kennedy Space Center, I had turned down the job twice, but I was offered the job again to become director of public affairs at the Manned, what was still the Manned Spacecraft Center at that time in Houston. That was 1972. So I took over that job and was there, of course, for the Skylab missions, and a real unique opportunity to travel the Soviet Union a whole number of times as part of the working group to negotiate the Apollo-Soyuz mission with the Russians. But part of the job of the Director of Public Affairs in Houston is he assigns a public affairs officer to each one of the families, and he is with them and whoever else they want to have with them, but there's always a public information, public affairs guy. Now, in each case, my people were instructed to follow the desires of the family, whatever they did or did not want to do. Of course, back in the early days, in the 60s, a number of things got out of control, but that was basically the concept. And each family, it would depend on their desires at the time. How much, if anything, they wanted to do with the media, or nothing to do with the media, and, of course, their They were just following their husbands and their dad's mission to outer space.
So it really would depend upon the family. It's like you look at...
Exactly right.
You look at Gus, who built his house with no windows in the front so the media would leave him alone. versus other families, which were a little bit more, I don't know, accommodating, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
So, okay, so then as... After Apollo 11, we have the space landing, and then we start building up through Apollo 13 and the near disaster that became the miracle. But then you had a tougher job, in that it seemed that NASA became a victim of its own success.
Well, not as much a victim of its own success. The key was the public attitude. And during the, as I say, during the 60s, all the way through to really the whole decade of the 60s, the public was behind us all the way, and that made a tremendous difference. Now, once we got in the latter phases of the Apollo program, of course, as you know, they cut, I believe it was three flights were cut out at the end of it. That was a combination of things, not as much the public as it was some of the same terrible conditions that we're facing now with our economy. There was an energy crisis at the time, and it just started to wane down a little bit under those circumstances. But it was on a tremendous high for about 10 years, I'll tell you that, and that made a big difference. So that's what actually occurred, and then the public interest started to pull off to a degree because we'd done it. Once again, I want to remind you, see, during that whole era, just about everything we were doing was for the first time. And when you do things for the first time, you can really grab people's interest.
I remember as a kid, and I want to thank you guys for doing this. I remember as a kid being able to write to NASA and get just about anything I wanted.
Yeah, they were very good on that. And the relations with the public were very good at that time.
And now you can just get it all off the internet. But I remember I remember just being so excited getting these giant envelopes filled with photographs.
Oh, sure.
And those were just really, really precious to me growing up as a kid. Had them all over my room. And so that I often wonder, you know, I guess maybe it's because it's all on the internet now. I just don't see NASA really trying to get the public excited. I don't know what it is, but I remember when the Sojourner rover landed on the moon, NASA had Hot Wheels done.
Yeah.
That you could, as kid, that kids could collect. I thought, that's genius. That's a great idea. But I don't see that anymore. If I was a NASA PA guy, I'd want to have Happy Meals at McDonald's. You know, with the Constellation program or the history.
Well, there's a lot of things to be judged along those lines. There's no question about it. Of course, one of the major differences now also is money. The support for the program, as far as Congress is concerned, both in the battles we've had in the shuttle program and the space station over the years. And, of course, that's continuing to a degree, even though the president seems to want to give support to the future of the program. We'll have to see.
Do you think that's because, like we touched on this earlier, do you think that's largely because the shuttle doesn't go anywhere?
Yeah, to a degree, yes, and it's really a shame, because the shuttle, as I said before, it's done a fantastic job in these last 30 years. It's putting together the space station and everything else. Now, the decision was made at the end of the Apollo program to go back to Earth orbit by developing the shuttle and the space station. I sort of agreed at the time with my boss at the time, Chris Kraft, and others who said, gee whiz, we're space cadets. We want to continue to go out. Just imagine if we had continued that journey on for the last 40 years, where would we be now as far as space exploration is concerned? But the determination was made for financial reasons and other reasons to develop the shuttle and operate in Earth orbit. For scientific purposes. So that was mainly the thing. But the shuttle is completely misunderstood. The job these crews have done in space are just amazing. We have six guys going around, guys meaning guys and gals, going around in that space station every day, and the public sort of takes it for granted until every now and then there might be some kind of problem that grabs their attention.
So you left NASA in 1975?
75, that's right. I got an offer I couldn't refuse that took me to Washington, D.C., and actually out of the space business. I was out of the space business about 25 years, and then back in 1997, my late wife and I lived in a nice condo up in Vienna, Virginia. I'd worked in Washington, D.C., and the kids were grown up, and everybody was doing fine. I bought her a little Mazda Miata as an anniversary present, and we came out one morning, it had snowed. We couldn't find the Mazda Miata. We looked at each other and said, let's get the heck out of here. And that's what brought us back to Florida. And, of course, the only place we'd come back to was Cocoa Beach. That was where we were married. Actually, my wife, Evelyn, was my secretary, and I fired her to marry her back in 1965. And our two youngest children were born in Cape Canaveral Hospital, and it was just one building. So there were a lot of special memories and a hometown aspect to us. So we came back at that particular time, and I had the opportunity to go to work for United Space Alliance. And so I just keep charging.
Just keep checking. Now, I noticed in your bio on Wikipedia, it says that your son, Chip, flew the longest F-14 Tomcat combat mission. Is he still in the Navy?
No, he's not. He's, we're very proud of him. That mission was just 1 month after 9/11, where Chip was the squadron commander and led the first attack into Kabul. They actually took off from the carrier, what, in the Persian Gulf, overflew Pakistan, and then went into Kabul and did the initial attacks, getting back after the 9/11, which had occurred a month before. It was a heck of a flight for him and his co-pilot, because as they just over Pakistan, they were supposed to refuel, and the plane was not there. So they had to make a decision that they went in and dropped their bombs and attacked into Kabul, turned around and came back, and they were on fumes by the time they found a tanker plane. There were three planes lined up, and he asked permission to go in just to get a couple of squirts of gas gas so that he could wait in line to head back. We were very proud of him. We were sitting on pins and needles when the announcements came in on what had occurred. Chip was F-14 pilot, F-14 fighter pilot for 20 years, and he decided if he continued, he was going to fly a desk for a few years, and he got an offer from Gulfstream Aviation to become a senior test pilot with Gulfstream up in Savannah, Georgia. And so he's been flying the Gulfstreams, particularly the Gulfstream 5, for the last 3 years.
So no interest in becoming an astronaut?
No, he never was. It was very interesting. But he always wanted to fly, and he got his wish, and we were very proud of him.
I have noticed that, and maybe this is because of the all-consuming nature of the program during Apollo, but I have noticed that there are no generational astronauts in the space program.
Well, of course, you've got it.
That nobody really wanted to follow in Dad's footsteps and go into the family business.
The one who went up on one of the recent missions.
Richard Garriott.
Garriott's son.
Who went.
So he followed in his dad's footsteps to a degree, meaning he made a flight. But I understand what you mean.
Yeah, I guess it's because they grew up without their fathers. Why would they want to do that to their own kids? I just thought that's an interesting dynamic.
Family.
All I'm saying, yeah, it's an interesting dynamic that nobody has followed in their father's footsteps.
Yeah.
So, okay. So looking back over Apollo and looking forward to Constellation from a public affairs point of view. And I know you work for the United Space Alliance, and I don't really want to put you in a position. But what do you think NASA has to do to really make this a reality, to get us back to the moon and to Mars? Do we just keep plugging away? What do you think?
Well, I think you have to keep plugging away. There's no question about it. We're going to have three or four test flights of the Ares, starting off with Ares 1X, which we're working on right now, which hopefully may go up in a couple of months. We'll see how that works out, and the program will have to develop from there, just as other programs have developed under those particular times. In the meantime, you're developing the Orion spacecraft and the lunar module. So hopefully all of these things will come together as they did in Apollo, hopefully in a reasonable amount of time and hopefully successfully. I personally, and I'm sure many of us in Apollo, wish them well and hope they outdo us by getting to Mars.
Does anybody in the current NASA PA office, do they pick your brain at all?
Occasionally.
When you look at the current state of technology in the world with the internet and with social media in Twitter and Facebook and people who like me who are doing podcasting, as a public affairs officer, you didn't have those tools. What do you think of these new tools that seem to be driving the news cycle and are being used in such an exciting way?
It's just amazing to me. I'm still being slowly dragged into the 21st century, and I'm doing the best I can at that. But it's quite amazing what goes on now, even to the fact that those particular means, Twitter and others, were used just to get the information out of Iran for a while here with the protests that were going on because the media had been shut down completely. And so it's just expanding all the time. I'm in my catch-up mode, as I was when I was chief of public information back in 1960, and the networks came to us and said they wanted us to set them up so that they could do their coverage. And I worked with Ken Grine, Colonel Ken Grine, who was the public information guy for the Air Force at that time. Now, my knowledge of TV was to go into the living room, move the rabbit ears a little bit, and if I was fortunate, I'd get a picture. And that's about as far as it went, but I was able to gather together the right people to do the job. And so that's sort of my background on those things. And hopefully I'm trying to keep up or at least catch up with all the fantastic things that are going on now.
I remember the launching of the first module of the International Space Station. I watched it live on the internet.
Yep, yep.
And I thought, my goodness, being a kid and seeing it live on just three networks, and now we're watching from behind the Iron Curtain, well, not really, but watching, you know, from Star City, Russia, which was behind the Iron Curtain. I'm watching it on the internet, and I thought that was just the greatest thing.
Yeah, it quite changes to a degree.
And now we have astronauts who are Twittering.
NASA for the Apollo 11 launch had three cameras, only one of which was, two of them were color, I think, at that particular time. Now, for the individual shuttle launches and others, you have more than 500 cameras out here doing all that coverage. So it's quite an amazing aspect.
Imagine 10 years from now, someone is a PA guy at NASA, and he's listening to this podcast just for fun. What do you say to him?
Do an excellent job. Make sure you do your homework in whatever particular area it is. Keep the public and the media in mind. The media is your outlet to the American public, and you've got to get your message out. It has to be clear, and it has to be interesting enough to excite the American people.
What do you think about going down in history as the voice of Apollo?
Well, I don't think of it too often, except for times like these, I guess, when you're coming up on the anniversary. But I guess my voice will be around quite a while after I'm gone.
You know, it's funny because even today, I will every once in a while, there's a group that has the entire Apollo mission on audio that you can download and listen to. And I downloaded it for the 40th anniversary to listen to it on my iPod. And even today, I kind of find myself almost feeling those pins and needles again.
Yeah.
Caught up in that historical feeling of each event as you winded it down to the countdown. And
well, that's the way the countdown went, you know. It made it more interesting where you start loading the propellants at about T-minus 9 hours in the count, and that's a liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen in the upper stages and the liquid oxygen in the RP. We already have the RP-1 fuel in the first stage, but you load the liquid oxygen in there as well. That takes up a major part of the final aspect of the count. And then you have a whole number of milestones that come down. And what always happened was at T minus 3 minutes and 10 seconds in the count, you get the signal firing command. What firing command means is what's going on in the Saturn V for the remaining part of the countdown is beyond human comprehension. the computer takes over, an RCA 110A computer, and like a ladder, it clicks off and verifies every event going on in that vehicle as the countdown continues. If something happens out of line or doesn't happen, the countdown will stop. Of course, we had a manual override on all of this, but that's the way the operation went. And so it made it more interesting along those lines, waiting for each one of these major milestones to occur late in the count. And so it really built up. And, of course, on Apollo 11, just going back to that to a degree, I remember very well going out there, probably get out there about 1 o'clock in the morning, left home a little bit earlier. I wanted to be out there in time for propellant loading. And I just sort of had a couple of rituals going out. I get my cup of coffee and donuts and be chomping on that. And, of course, more than 750,000 people had come into the Brevard County area and the Cocoa Beach area to view the launch personally. And so when I was driving out there, the town was still very much alive. There was still quite a bit of traffic. And I was just amazed at just the line of cars, tents, RVs. Everybody had already picked out their location and was spending the night just to make sure they could hold on to it. All along the beach going out as I drove out to the first the Cape Kennedy Air Force Station and then across the causeway to the Complex 39 where we had our launch pads and the launch control center. There's a causeway that connects the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station to the NASA facility. And once I crossed the bridge in complete darkness, I pulled the car off the side of the road and just step outside for a moment, and there was this majestic vehicle sitting all alone. I'm looking at it across the lagoon, bathed in the floodlights. And I just stand there and admire it for about 2 minutes or so. It was sort of just a Saturn V and me. Then I jumped back into the car and headed out to the control room. Everybody looked the same in the control room. My goodness, we'd been together for 8 or 9 years as a launch team, and all the familiar faces were there, all in the same positions. But everything really was different because then every one of us knew inside that this was very different that morning. The countdown turned out to be one of the smoothest countdowns we'd ever had with the Saturn V. We'd already had 5 of them before that time. We had a minor problem with a communications malfunction light and a minor leak in a liquid hydrogen vent valve on the third stage of the Saturn V. Both of those were fixed readily, and we continued with the count. The times were 10 or 15 minutes ahead in the countdown. As dawn broke, it turned out to be a beautiful morning, hardly a cloud in the sky, and a temperature of about 85 degrees. About that time, the crew boarded the Apollo spacecraft, and Neil Armstrong, Mike Collins, and Buzz Aldrin, and they boarded the spacecraft and settled in. The countdown continued to click down, and everything seemed to go well. At the T-minus 5-minute mark, the launch operations manager, Paul Donnelly, polled the various outlets to get the go, no-go, and everybody came back with a loud, firm go. Paul then wished the astronauts well and recited an old Irish blessing, which starts with, "May the road rise up to meet you, may the wind always be at your back." And the countdown continued. It was in the closing moments of the count, where really the atmosphere in the control room was electric, because we all knew what was riding on this particular mission. And as I'm listening to the final moments, I'm a lifelong Red Sox fan, so as a result, I'm always waiting for something to go bad. But that particular morning, nothing went bad. And we clicked down, and when we reached that 3-minute and 10-second mark, the networks and the news media asked me to talk down the countdown from there. So I just, my practice was just to continue saying what was going on and really coming up almost every 10 seconds to let them know what was up. And the countdown proceeded right down that line. And we hit it. The final aspect of the count is when you get to 9.8 seconds in the countdown, those 5 big engines in the Saturn V come alive, they ignite, and it takes that amount of time to go to zero so that the engines will build up the full thrust, the 7.5 million pounds of thrust needed for liftoff. When we hit 1 in the countdown, we get the confirmation, all engines running. And then comes the key signal. It's called commit. Commit tells the launch vehicle to release, and those five giant swing arms, which are still connected to the vehicle up to that point, pull back, and that mighty vehicle lifts off the pad.
It's a truly remarkable experience. Even today, I remember reading that during the filming of Apollo 13, the filmmakers actually considered using the original launch footage because the footage was so clear and so dramatic and so well done.
That always surprised me also. It's quite a tribute to them that they were able to do it themselves, but that footage was awfully good that we had.
Yeah,
and, of course, their footage, that was a great movie. It was, definitely.
So speaking of footage, word on the street is that NASA finally found the original broadcast tapes of the Apollo 11 moon landing.
I haven't heard the latest on that. I'm happy to hear that if that's the case. Because people have been in contact with me all the way from Australia and elsewhere, making suggestions and all kinds of things. But I don't know all the details on that. I'm happy to hear it.
So, what's next for Jack King? Are you gonna be writing a book?
Oh no, there's been enough books written. Actually, I figure I'll stick around out here for about another year. As I say, these guys keep me young out here. I'm still making a contribution, and I get a lot of satisfaction out of it.
Okay. Well, I've been talking to the voice of Apollo, NASA Public Affairs Officer Jack King, the man who gave us those dramatic descriptions during every Apollo launch save one. Jack, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, James. Good to talk to you.
You've been listening to Conversations with Apollo. For more information, visit our website at www.apollotalks.com. Got a question or comment? There's several ways to get a hold of us. Drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com. You can leave us feedback on the iTunes website. You can now tweet us on Twitter @@ApolloTalks. And we're also on Facebook with Apollo Talks. Theme music is from Gemini 5, courtesy of the MySpace Music Network. The song is Babylon Rockets. Visit them on the web at www.gemini5.com. Conversations with Apollo is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quindar Entertainment. Copyright 2009.